I'm Anna Sale, in today for Leonard Lopate. If you smoked Colombian weed in the 1970s and 1980s, I owe you a thank you card. That's the message to readers early in the new memoir by Tony DeCoppel. He's a senior writer for NBC News, and his memoir is part family history, part history of the radical changes in our country's drug laws and drug culture in the 70s and 80s. And Tony DeCoppel's father was right at the center of it. If you smoked that Colombian weed, he notes, you paid for his swimming lessons, his first baseball glove, and kept him in private school with some of President George H.W. Bush's grandsons, at least for a while. Then it all fell apart. Tony DeCoppel tells that story in his new book, The Last Pirate, A Father, His Son, and the Golden Age of Marijuana. It's published by Doubleday, and Tony DeCoppel joins me in studio. Hello, Tony.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Give me a sense of the scale of your father's smuggling operation at its height.
At its height, he was doing more than 10 tons a year. And in a single job in 1986, he broke a weeks-long shortage in America with a 17-ton load. And if you think that there's a gram in every joint, 17 tons of cleaned, pruned marijuana is enough for millions upon millions of joints.
He interrupted a weeks-long shortage, which had to do with drug policy in the country, which you trace right along with your family story in this book. Just start, when was smoking marijuana actually illegal in the United States?
So, I mean, states had very draconian laws against marijuana for decades, but in the late 1960s, when college kids started smoking in mass, the federal government actually didn't have it banned. There was a tax, right, the marijuana tax, and if you didn't pay it, you could be fined or you could go to jail for tax fraud. But it wasn't until Richard Nixon decided that he didn't really like all these people who voted against him and who were also smoking marijuana and who wanted to be tough on crime. He finally passed the Controlled Substances Act in 1970 and said, okay, marijuana is not only illegal now, it's officially among the most dangerous drugs ever known to man, and it's going to be Schedule One. And we know how that worked out.
So before President Nixon, however, you describe a Life magazine issue from 1967 about increasing use of pot. And it's noting the increase, but it's not portrayed as a crisis. It's more the article is about dispelling old fears about this drug.
Yeah, it's really astounding. And I encourage people to look at these archives. Life magazine has everything online. You can get to it easily. In 1967, Life did a huge, huge double gatefold where it basically said to all the parents reading, relax. You might have young kids. They're probably it was the 4th of July issue. So you imagine these long weekends, you know, hours at the grill, sparklers. And if there were kids back from school and having a good time, parents were told basically just don't worry about it. It's going to be fine. The drug laws are a problem. The drug itself, not an issue.
So your parents are coming of age in the late 60s. How did your father get involved in dealing drugs?
He started smoking marijuana, and at a certain point he figured he could start selling it as well. He also didn't have a whole lot else going for him. At the time, he had washed out of graduate school, come east, and was working as a security guard at an off-season security guard at a beach house or beach complex. And then he met a guy at a bar who did some construction work, and it was all just a cover for drugs. And one thing led to another, and he was like, you know what? I can do what this guy's doing. He's an idiot, and I'm slightly less an idiot, so I'll give it a shot.
And it picks up pace after he hooks up with some concert circuits.
Right. So his first partner was plugged into a guy who ran a concert business in Connecticut, and it was a huge business. All the big acts went through. My mother's files, when I opened them on this, had all kinds of agent photos of, like, ZZ Top and Alabama, and it had the numbers on there just in case I might want to call them for a birthday party. And, you know, my father's job, his very first cover profession, was to drive around New England and deliver tickets to these concerts. So in the old days, you had to drop off the paper ticket at really cool, like, denim shops and so he did that, and then he'd return for the evening and, of course, be moving backstage, front stage, and the crowd would be overhung with smoke from the pot that he was selling.
How did your father and mother meet?
God, they met my father during a crossroads moment where he didn't know what he was going to do with his life. Before he got into dealing, he was in a bar, and she walked in, and he didn't he needed a place to stay, and there were four girls, and they were all cute, and he was like, I'm going to talk to all four. And she was the one who talked back.
When did she realize that he was dealing drugs?
I mean, immediately. At first, she was a bigger deal than him because she lived in a college apartment with four other girls, and they threw parties funded by their own drug sales. So when he got an opportunity to step up in the business, to connect directly to the concert thrower, he needed a buy-in. He needed $2,000. And my mother immediately tried to go to the teacher's credit union and get a loan for him because she felt so passionately that the government was wrong about this particular drug. And so that didn't work out, but she did get a loan from her father, and that launched the whole business.
That's what is so interesting about what you describe. It's these equal and opposite forces, increasing crackdown and increasing use and proliferation of the drug culture. You write, to smoke marijuana was to realize that the government had lied about the demon narcotic and to wonder what else they were lying about.
Yeah, it became a symbol of everything else that was wrong with America. And, you know, you can thank Richard Nixon for doing this. I mean, I think marijuana is popular and legal today in part because he tried to stamp it out of existence. There was a sense in the late 1960s when, by the way, 5% of college kids in 1968 had tried marijuana. It was like out of sight. No one was doing it. 5 years later, it was close to 50%. So it exploded, and everyone thought it was like the hula hoop. There were like real serious public policy types being like, don't worry about it, it's going to go away, it's a fad. And then Nixon makes it, you know, outlaws it, tries to shut down the border of Mexico and cracks down on dealers. And by doing so, he created the drug, right? I mean, to hate Nixon was to like marijuana and vice versa. And so we really, the flourishing we see in Colorado and Washington, to the extent that you enjoy seeing it, you should also thank your lucky stars for Richard Nixon.
How did your father take advantage of this new interest? Where did he find these new users?
I mean, you could find them everywhere. He didn't have to deal with the street users. Because he was also into heroin, which was booming in the white middle class in the early 1970s as well. He had a built-in ring of people around him who were kind of outside of mainstream society and interested in getting extra cash. So his first sellers were drug users themselves.
But you said he liked to think about the end user and picture where his pot was ending up.
I mean, because he really felt like he was, a magical giver of sweet dreams and sex in the mud and wonderful songs on the guitar. So he didn't feel like he ever created a bad day, only good days. And so whenever he made a sale, he liked to see when the money came all the way back up the chain to him, and it was in fives or ones because he knew it was street money.
So you're a child during this time. You're growing up in the early 80s. What do you remember about your father when you were a boy?
I just remember he was a big, clowning, joshing, physical presence. He was a classic father in that sense. He wasn't always there, but when he was there, it was upside-down tickling time. And I thought he had a legitimate real estate business in Vermont, which he did have, just wasn't legitimate.
And the cash was flowing.
The cash was flowing, and I was born into quite a lot of luxury that I didn't realize I was surrounded by. I mean, we had a beautiful Mercedes. My mother had a new Volvo with new speakers in it. We had vacations all over the place. Most kids that are two don't have passports stamped with a bunch of Caribbean islands, and I just did.
So you mentioned your father helped address a weeks-long pot shortage in the mid-1980s. What caused that shortage?
So Reagan was actually very successful not only in changing people's ideas about pot, but in rooting it out of existence. From 1982 to 1986, the domestic market growers in America were coming online in huge numbers, and Project Camp was launched by Reagan. This was like the helicopters over California, U-2 spy planes, 100-man marching armies through the woods, and they just ripped out the domestic market, just cut it down.
Camp stood for?
Campaign Against Marijuana Production. You're lucky I was able to get that.
That's good. So it's focusing on outdoor fields of marijuana, and they target that supply.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, this was front page news for the 3 years up until 1986. And 1985 was such a big year that many farmers were like, let's take 1986 off, and we'll figure out a way to go indoors. We're going to rethink our game here. And, of course, that move indoors is the big bang for what we see today, where in Colorado and Washington, everything is grown indoors. If you're growing outside, it's really, not the same. Anyway, so that created an opening for my father, who would have been, ancient histories, like the, I don't want to make a media metaphor, but, he would have been pushed out of existence if not for Reagan's, assist.
I'm speaking with Tony DeCoppo. His new book is The Last Pirate, A Father, His Son, and the Golden Age of Marijuana. So what did your father do to take advantage of that opening in the market? Where was his supply?
Well, he had connected with a guy who could get an unlimited amount of Colombian reefer. And so what that guy needed was a guy who could move it in large quantities. And so my father was the first American to touch it when it got to the United States. And he'd been working with that individual for about 8 years by 1986. And so when they realized, you know, judging by the articles in High Times and the just in the newspaper coverage that a different kind of marijuana was coming online, and that their days in the sun were numbered, they figured we're supposed to be retired, we're supposed to be done, but let's do it one more time, and let's do it bigger than we've ever done before. And so they came up with 35,000 pounds, which was a number that the feds used to throw around as enough for a single day supply in America. And they, you know, they pulled it off. My father's partner got 6 sailboats packed with weed up along the coast, and my father received it and sold it lickety-split, as you like to say.
How did he get the pot from Key West up the East Coast?
Well, that was an earlier operation. He, for no reason other than he just liked the thrill of it, would rent or he would use Winnebagos with specialized shocks that his other partner, the mechanic, would put on, drive it down the only road into Key West, pull off at a predetermined location, and then with the help of the suppliers, load the thing up with tons of marijuana, pack it everywhere, you know, in the, you know, under the every storage space, on top of everything, and then flick a switch so that it wasn't sagging, it would lift up, and then he would take that glorious Route 1 all the way up the coast.
He also had some stops to bury money along the way.
Right. So my father had a legitimate laundering method.
Legitimate laundering
method. Yeah, I mean, like, right. Okay, so he had a successful operational way of laundering his money, but it required actual work. Like, when he was building fake houses and then selling them with drug money, I mean, real houses, but selling them with drug money, it cleaned things, but, you know, he had to do things, and he didn't want to do that at a certain point. So as his own personal drug use took off, money piled up, brain cells boiled away, and he started burying money like an idiot. And we dug up in 87, my mother and I drove to New Mexico to dig up one well of money, which was then comically lost. And there are other wells that may or may not still exist. I don't know. I have reports of him filling a shed with shovels, one for each well, and only two of those wells were recovered. So I need to find them. If anyone does, give me a call.
So you were with your mother in New Mexico digging up that cash. But as a small boy, there's a lot of this you didn't know.
No, I actually had no idea why we'd gone to New Mexico. In retrospect, it's extremely bizarre. Who takes a Winnebago to Albuquerque for a one-day stop and then returns? There was no purpose for the trip. We were visiting my cousins, right? Okay. So it's ridiculous. But when I asked my mother about this, and she said, well, you were a kid. You can lie to kids. It's easy. You can trick kids.
The authorities eventually caught up with your father.
Yes. He would like me to point out that he was never caught. He was turned in, which is a big distinction. To make this a really big melodrama, my mother married my stepfather, who had been a partner of my father's. And when the guy in Colombia who was getting the weed got arrested, he rolled on my stepfather, who rolled on my father. And 3 indictments followed, and yeah, my dad went to jail.
How long was he in prison?
He was in custody for 18 months, which is a very short amount of time for a couple reasons. One, he drew a good judge. One of his partners in Virginia got more than 10 years. And this was also – so he drew a good judge, but also he cooperated. You know, he told on people too, unfortunately.
The picture I get of your father from reading the book is that he's a fun person to be around, but he wasn't always there when you were growing up. What was it like – to go back and ask him about his life in this time when he was not only selling but using and in and out of your life?
You know, it was mystifying because what one expects in their great cathartic moment when they confront the parent who wasn't there is for the parent to say, I regret everything and I would have done it differently. But my father has never, ever said he would do it differently. He says sometimes nonsensically that he would do everything the same except he wouldn't leave me. But, of course, that wouldn't be doing everything the same. And, yeah, even he loved the great change in register. He liked having no money and then millions of dollars and then no money again. He wanted the rise and fall. Criminals are funny that way. They want the full spectrum of experience. I mean, academics look at this kind of stuff. There's an arc to the criminal life. Because if you don't have that arc, if you don't fall, and if you're not eventually arrested, you get no applause. You're not recognized in any way. This book exists because he was busted, right? If he'd been successful and the con was still going on, I probably wouldn't know, and we'd just be comfortably wealthy. And that would be boring to him, and boring is the enemy.
And how did you find out? Tell me about the moment you discovered the scale of the kind of dealing that he was doing.
Right. So I thought, I mean, like anyone, I assumed that whatever my parents were doing was kind of pathetic and, you know, uncool. And so when they would talk about, I would hear rumors around the kitchen table about marijuana dealing, I thought it was typical hippie stuff. And then on the brink of becoming a father myself, I decided I wanted facts. And I'd become a journalist at this point and I needed a story. So I was like, I'm going to see what's up with this. So I called, I did first a local court records search and got nothing of significance. And then I called the National Archive on a lark. National Archive is the keeper of 1% of all the records in America, the most important things. And I said, do you have anything on the exploits of one Anthony Edward DeCoppel? And they did.
And they did. And you found out 35,000.
Yeah, I did. And they sent me a fax of his indictment. And I opened it up and it was like, well, zounds. That's a lot of marijuana.
And quickly, how do you feel about decriminalization of marijuana?
Well, see, if I have to come down in one camp or another, I'm for decriminalization and a little wary of full legalization. It's kind of a conservative position that's born of an extremely liberal point of view.
And some personal experience. Tony DeCoppel is the author of the new book, The Last Pirate, A Father, His Son, and the Golden Age of Marijuana. It's published by Doubleday. Tony, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you very much for having me.